Take a network break. I'm Drew Conry Murray.
And I'm Jonna Johnson.
We're rolling out the apple cider virtual donuts for the fall season. We're also going to be talking about a SolarWinds vulnerability that's being exploited, a Mac vulnerability discovered by Microsoft, big tech investments in small modular nuclear reactors, TSMC financial results, and more. No sponsors today, but I do want to let you know we've launched a Packet Pushers merch store. It's at store.packetpushers.net, or you can just find a link at the top of the homepage at packetpushers.net. If you want shirts, hoodies, mugs, or more, or notebooks and so on with your favorite podcast logo, including Network Break with a virtual donut. It's all there. We've got a bunch of designs already up. We'll be adding more designs and options over time. And if you have go to the store and see something that you would like and it's not there, you can always hit us up at packetpushers.net/FU for follow-up to tell us what you would like to see. We just launched the store, so we're working on it, but go check it out. There's stuff in there. It's at store.packetpushers.net if you always wanted to flaunt a Packet Pushers t-shirt or something else.
And Drew, all I can say is thank God we're pushing out the apple cider virtual donuts and not the pumpkin spice ones, because those things are noxious.
We don't do pumpkin spice here on Network Break, just so you know.
Good choice. Good choice.
We do have a sponsor at the end. We've got a Tech Bytes podcast, and we're welcoming back Cisco ThousandEyes. We're going to be talking about new features that improve visibility into both the public cloud and your on-prem network. We're going to get details on a new topographical mapping feature for AWS, as well as ThousandEyes' new capability to consume flow records from on-prem and correlate those records with ThousandEyes synthetic testing. You can hear that at the end of this episode. Let's get back into the news. Hard-coded credentials in SolarWinds' web help desk product are now being exploited. That's according to the U.S. Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, or CISA. The vulnerability was announced back in August of 2024, and SolarWinds did release a software update to fix it. However, CISA has now added this vulnerability to its known exploited vulnerabilities catalog, meaning that there is reliable evidence of an active exploit. So if you haven't gotten around to it, you may want to go check. SolarWinds is encouraging web help desk customers to deploy the software update, and it says it has seen no activity against patch systems. That's according to a story in the Register.
And that sound that you are not hearing, because we've got good directional mics, is me banging my head against the table going, oh my gosh, what kind of morons will hard code credentials, particularly when they are a security vendor? I mean, this is beyond bonkers. So
yeah. It's bad.
And I would not believe SolarWinds on this, that they have seen no activity against that they've seen no activity against patch systems. Okay. I would hurry up and join the group of the patch systems as quickly as possible, because that is a bad vulnerability. It's a stupid vulnerability. And I mean, if you know about it and you didn't patch, you're going to look almost as stupid as SolarWinds did for having it.
Exactly. Don't be in that party.
Yeah, exactly. Don't be that guy or gal. And moving right along to vulnerabilities discovered in an amusing about face, Microsoft has discovered a Mac OS vulnerability. I do love this. It's funny.
I do love it too.
Microsoft Threat Intelligence identified a vulnerability called HM Surf in Mac OS that could allow attackers to bypass the operating system's transparency, consent, and control, the TTC technology, potentially gaining unauthorized access to protected user data. And here's where it gets really funny. The source of the vulnerability is Safari. Microsoft has reported the vulnerability to Apple, which addressed the issue. It's now called CVE-2024-44133. That's 44133. And Apple has addressed it in the security updates for Mac OS Sequoia, which was released on September 16th, 2024. And again, attackers can exploit by disabling TTC protection for the Safari browser and altering a config file within the browser's directory, according to Microsoft. But it does not affect third-party browsers such as Google Chrome, Mozilla Firefox, and Microsoft Edge if you happen to be running them on your Mac, which is just really funny. Like, if you're running the Microsoft browser, you're fine. But if you're running the Apple browser, you're not. Me personally, I would never run the built-in browser for all of those reasons. So, you know, I would be running Chrome on a Microsoft machine or Firefox on a Mac. There's good solid principles to always have a heterogeneous environment for exactly that reason. But in any event, if you aren't willing to do that and have been using Safari, you probably want to patch that vulnerability.
Yeah, we have a link to the full Microsoft Threat Intelligence report if you want to get into the nitty-gritty, but the vulnerability does allow an attacker to get access to user data, to pages browsed in Safari, as well as access to the camera, the microphone, location data, and so on. And I've got to wonder if maybe there was a little smugness in the Microsoft threat research team when they delivered this to Apple.
I think maybe a little more than a little. I certainly would forgive them if they were super smug. They have the right.
Moving on, Amazon has signed agreements with power companies in Washington State and Virginia to enable the development of small modular nuclear reactors, or SMRs. SMRs have a smaller physical footprint than traditional reactors and can be built closer to distribution systems and electrical grids. That's according to Amazon. In Washington State, Amazon is going to, quote, fund the initial feasibility phase of an SMR project, end quote. And this is according to Energy Northwest, which is a consortium of state electrical utilities that Amazon signed this deal with. If the reactor does get built, Amazon also gets the right to purchase power from the first four modules, about 320 megawatts worth. Additional modules could generate as much as 640 more megawatts, and Amazon also has the option to buy that power, along with having it be for homes and business customers. The project isn't expected to come online if it happens until the early 2030s. Amazon has also joined in the funding round of a startup called X Energy that builds SMRs. This was a C funding round of $500 million. Amazon's described as an anchor, but the round had a total of five investors, so I'm not sure how much money Amazon is actually putting down here.
Yeah, and I think this is just yet another indication that big tech companies and others are seeing data center energy demands rise, and increased energy usage is destroying their own goals for reducing their carbon footprint to the extent that they're taking those goals seriously. I would say that the big tech companies are usually more worried about simply not having enough energy. As I think we reported on a previous network break, Google pulled out of building a data center in Ireland because Ireland could not guarantee the energy. And I pointed out at the time that Iceland is actually building really fat pipes to various locations, including to Ireland, because Iceland has, aside from volcanoes, a plethora of energy for data centers. So I expect to see some real activity in Iceland going forward. But the point here, Drew, is that it's almost like everything old is new again, because, you know, nuclear power was something we were going to retire to the dustbin of history. And now you've got Microsoft reactivating Three Mile Island, right, as well as investing in, you know, the modular nuclear power. And now we've got Amazon. So, and, you know, presumably Google as well.
Yeah, it's interesting to see Amazon actually not just signing agreements with utility companies, which you'd expect, but putting money behind companies building small modular reactors, because these projects are difficult. They're hard to get off the ground. If Amazon sees an opportunity here to help meet its energy demands, it makes sense that they'd want to put a little muscle behind companies actually building these things as well. So again, though, we are, you know, years and years off from seeing this come to fruition if it does, because inevitably you get into issues about, does the local community want this built here, and so on. The potential dangers of nuclear reactors tend to scare people. So we'll see how it plays out. But Amazon is definitely trying to get this going.
Well, the years and years is the other piece of the everything old is new again, because we, in our upcoming episode on heavy strategy, we talked about some of the sort of interesting insights from a conference that we had both been to. And one of the interesting insights was we learned quite a bit about the Dragonfly project, which is the project that's sending a drone to Titan, and trying to wrap my head around this project, because it's an 18-year project that's not expected to conclude until 2037. These are the kinds of things that people used to do in technology back in the 50s and 60s. They'd make these, you know, huge multi-decadal plans and sometimes even execute on them. And somehow or other, since the turn of the century, the window of planning has dropped from decades to years to quarters to months to weeks at this point.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to see tech companies sort of reverting to making plans that are, you know, that won't see fruition for, as you said, years and years to come.
Yeah, I sort of, some of the coverage is sort of slanted that way. Like, why are they bothering if it's not going to happen for years? And I feel like, well, sometimes that's how technology works, and you do need to make those foundational investments to make things happen. So I don't think it's an issue that it's going to take years, because that's just what it takes. But if you're going to start it, you might as well start it now.
Yeah, and not doing it means that you're banking on some technology coming along to, you know, save your bacon in the interim, which is, you know, hope is not a strategy.
Right, exactly.
That way. Sometimes you just have to make the best decision you can at the time. And who knows, maybe folks will come up with much better infrastructure that reduces the energy requirements yet again. Who knows? But it is a smart move for these companies.
Yeah.
Speaking of smart moves for companies, T-Mobile is releasing its first 5G RedCap device. In collaboration with device maker TCL, T-Mobile is releasing a device built to the 5G reduced capacity, that is RedCap specification, which it claims is a first in North America. If you're not familiar with RedCap, it is designed specifically to support IoT devices like wearables that don't need the full feature set or connectivity speed or anything else of a 5G network connection, but still would benefit from being able to run on a 5G network. So by reducing the feature set for these devices' 5G chips, they can be simpler, cheaper, and more power efficient. Interestingly, though, this first device is not an IoT device. It's a simple hotspot for $100 for providing wireless internet access to a laptop or tablet rather than a wearable. So it's designed for folks, consumers and enterprise users who want to upgrade their current devices with 5G connectivity without needing to buy entirely new devices. And again, I think the list price is about $96 for this thing. So very interesting, certainly space to keep your eye on.
Yeah, it makes sense to me. For one, you know, all the service providers, the telcos are trying to find new ways to leverage 5G. The more devices you can get on that, the better for them. And if you can, I'd never heard of the RedCap specification, but it makes sense. If I just need simple connectivity, if I can get a cheaper chipset to do that, then yeah, why not? And we know IoT devices are proliferating, so I'm not surprised to see this happening.
Yeah, no, it makes perfect sense. I'm just sort of mildly surprised, I guess is the way to put it, to see that the first RedCap device is actually a hotspot.
Well, you got to start somewhere.
You do, but I mean, it's kind of an interesting space because it's like highly competitive. So right. We'll see. And moving right along, Palo Alto Security is co-pilots have exited the trials going into general availability. So if you are a Palo Alto user, Palo Alto is now releasing its LLM-driven AI co-pilots for Strata, Prisma Cloud, and Cortex co-pilots, which have been in customer trials since May. In Strata, the co-pilot's job is to provide a natural language interface to aid in threat detection and response. In Prisma Cloud, it'll support policy creation and compliance monitoring. And in Cortex, the co-pilot is meant to help in security operations, providing actionable recommendations for incident response. In all three platforms, the co-pilot will also provide query-based access into documentation, which is a biggie, configuration data, and threat data. Databases, which turns out to be one of the unsung wins for AI, is providing exactly that. You just ask the question and the answer comes up. You don't have to figure out how the documentation is organized to, you know, to locate the answer to the specific question that you've got.
Yeah, we're seeing lots of vendors roll out these sort of co-pilots or helpers using Gen AI and trained on internal documentation, knowledge bases, and so on. I do think it's a good use case for an LLM and for generative AI because you want that domain-specific information to reduce, you know, hallucination and misinformation that a Gen AI system can produce. Yeah, it makes sense that I assume, particularly with threat databases and configuration data and so on, Palo Alto has a lot of data it can draw on to help train these models. So curious to see how this works out.
Exactly. And I think they can run them very cold, meaning not hallucinating, with a very controlled data set. So I expect to see this extremely highly functional. So we'll see. Next up in the new specifications, new FIDO specifications have been announced with the goal of securely transferring passkeys among providers. The FIDO Alliance, which includes Apple, Microsoft, Okta, Samsung, and a bunch of others, has just announced and published early drafts of two new protocol specifications, a credential exchange format, CXF, and a credential exchange protocol, CXP. The goal is to support the secure export, transmission, and import of passkey information between two providers. As most of our listeners know, passkeys are standardization of a form of passwordless authentication meant to make social engineering, password reuse across platforms, and brute force attacks much less of a threat. The idea is you are using very strong passwords because you don't have to remember them. The FIDO Alliance is expected to release a draft for public comment early next year in 2025.
Yeah, great to see. I mean, the more we can do to support the ability for these passkeys to be shared, the less burden we put on users trying to have all of these constraints around what they can use for passwords. I think NIST just also revamped its guidelines around password recommendations for best practices, and they're getting rid of things like you must have these numbers of, you know, special characters and caps, uppercase and lowercase and so on, in favor of just use a longer word or a longer passphrase.
Well, and if you're not quite ready to jump to a passkey, I will pass along the best algorithm for creating passwords that I've heard. One of my colleagues has a really great memory for song lyrics. So he basically picks an entirely obscure song and then takes alternating lines from the songs with a few tweaks and changes that and customizations that only he knows. So literally, unless you grew up in the 80s and have a photographic memory for song lyrics, good luck guessing the next one, even with AI.
I like that algorithm.
I know, it's a good one.
I could put that one to use, yes.
Yeah, and there's all different ways you can play with it. You can always take the first letter of each sentence or whatever. It's not easily guessable.
Yeah. Two more stories before we wrap. First, the chip manufacturer TSMC reported its Q3 financial results. The company had revenues of 759 billion new Taiwan dollars, which converts to 23.5 billion in U.S. dollars. Revenue was up 39% over this time last year. Their quarterly net income was up 54% year over year. The company said its results were driven by demand for smartphone chips as well as AI, of course. And the company estimates that its AI chip revenue accounts for less than a fifth of its revenue for all of 24. It does say that demand is real and is going to continue for years. TSMC is also spending billions of dollars on new fabrication plants, including $65 billion for three plants in the U.S. That's according to Reuters.
Yeah, which are all signs of a chip company that is just firing on all cylinders, doing everything right, surfing the current waves, AI and smartphones, and of course, investing in the U.S. because it is well aware of U.S. policy on those issues. So all good. I mean... It's off to them.
It's hard to complain about results like that, yeah.
Exactly.
So, John, we're going to wrap up with some space networking.
We are indeed. And we've been doing a lot of space networking lately, which is a good thing, I think.
I love to see it, yeah.
Yeah, so new space internet player emerges to serve the European telecom provider market. Constellation Technologies and Operations intends to develop a space-based network of satellites, as opposed to, I don't know, the satellites that are ground-based, with the goal of selling services to telecom operators for resale to their customers. Their plan at present is to launch satellites into VLEO, so orbits lower than 400 kilometers or 250 miles, and to use them to provide 5G cellular internet connectivity. The plan is tailored to the telecom provider space. In other words, their customers are the telecom providers, and they will leverage the 5G provider's own 5G spectrum licenses to underpin the services. They've raised 9 million euros to support end-to-end testing, always a good thing, ground to orbit to ground, and engineering for the first pair of satellites. So basically, once again, what Constellation is doing here is selling satellite services to telcos who will go on to sell them to the telco customers, ideally.
That's clever. So it's almost like satellite as a service.
There you go.
Yeah. And also, I think that using spectrum that's already been licensed to the telcos is a smart move, too, because then you have fewer hoops to jump through regulation-wise.
Exactly. And your customers already are just ready to go. So this is interesting. Definitely something to keep an eye on, particularly if you are in Europe. That's something that could be available sooner rather than later, given the pace of innovation in that particular area.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, we'll keep an eye on that. All right, that wraps up the news portion of the show. Stay tuned for our Tech Bytes conversation with Cisco ThousandEyes on new visibility features for public cloud and on-prem networks. That's coming right up. Today in the Tech Bytes podcast, we welcome back sponsor Cisco ThousandEyes, and we're going to talk about new features that improve visibility into both the public cloud and your on-prem network. We'll get details on the new topographical mapping feature for AWS, as well as ThousandEyes' new ability to consume flow records from on-prem and correlate those records with ThousandEyes synthetic testing. Our guest is Marco Tisler, Director of Product at ThousandEyes. Marco, welcome to Tech Bytes, and let's start with that ThousandEyes Cloud Insights. What are the new capabilities here?
Thanks, Drew. I'm excited to be here and excited to talk about some of the new capabilities that we've built. First of all, for those that don't know ThousandEyes and what we do, so we assure digital experiences, and traditionally our bread and butter has been providing visibility into networks that you don't own, mm-hmm. the internet or the cloud. But as we kind of evolved, we've found the need to expand the visibility back into the owned networks, which is the enterprise perimeter or the owned network infrastructure, but then also into the cloud networking. And this is where Cloud Insights comes into play. So Cloud Insights provide visibility beyond the entry point into the cloud environment and into the logical connectivity chain within your cloud environments, all the way to the application. The idea being that we assure digital experiences or the network path all the way from the network interface that is used by the user's device to access the network resources, to the other side where the application connects to the network either through a virtual NIC or a physical NIC if that's in a data center. So that is what we define as the path that we assure.
So thinking about Cloud Insights then, does this mean like before with Thousand Eyes, I'd sort of get a view up to like a VPC or a transit gateway, but now I can get further in, or what are we talking about?
Yeah, so traditionally you would get to the entry point into the cloud and then you would see nothing, and then you would see the app. Now we expanded visibility into what's happening in between those two points, which is what other logical services are in between, like load balancers and so on, how they are connected. And what's really interesting is how does that logical topology change over time? Because sometimes the changes in the topology might be correlated with the degradation of digital experiences, for example. And the other thing is how do the configuration of those logical nodes in the path, how do the changes in the configuration of those nodes affect digital experiences? Because you know what might happen and what we actually see happening is somebody pushes or something pushes a security group configuration change. And by something, I mean, it could be your automation. And suddenly the traffic stops flowing and the application starts having problems. And those types of things we can identify in Cloud Insights.
So Cloud Insights has... Do you have deep access into my VPC and related cloud environment where you know what the security policies are and can point out the security policy?
Yeah. So what we do is we read the configuration and we do a diff between the configuration before and after. And then we can tell you, okay, this disappeared or this was removed or this was added at this point in time. And then we correlate that with the traffic flow. So typically what you will see is you remove a security policy and suddenly the traffic drops, for example. We can temporally correlate those two events, and which points you to, oh, this change happened. Somebody removed something from the configuration and then the traffic pattern significantly changed.
Now, I think this is interesting because, you know, obviously, if I'm in the AWS or whatever cloud console, I can see what kind of network connectivity and policies I have in place. But what you're also bringing to this is the fact that you're also showing me the path before I hit that cloud environment and then putting it together for me.
Yeah, correct. So you see the before and after, and you see how it's really about what I call change intelligence. So how did the path and the traffic look like before an occurrence of a particular event? What happened during the event and then how it looked out after. And then you can go back and forth in time to understand how the changes affected your digital experiences. That's kind of the key. So having that historical context and being able to go back in time and forward in time.
Yeah, that's making more sense then, because if a user starts complaining about traffic degradation or there's an app issue, I've got records and I can go back and forth in time and see, oh, this, it looks like, you know, some action was kicked off that made this change and maybe we should go back and fix that or rethink that change.
Exactly.
So what clouds are supported with this Cloud Insight?
Right now, we support AWS. We are working on supporting other hyperscalers. But right now, the support is available and the product is in limited preview for AWS environments.
Okay, so starting with AWS, but extending to the usual suspects, I assume.
That is correct, yes.
Okay, so that's Cloud Insights. You also recently announced Traffic Insights, and this is focused on on-prem networks, which I think is kind of new territory for Thousand Eyes.
Yes. So from the perspective of owned network infrastructure, we've always been present there, but it was treated as a transit, like just like any other transit, in a sense that, you know, Thousand Eyes Synthetics, they work at layer three. So any layer three node, irregardless whether it is across the internet or in the owned infrastructure is identified. But what we've heard from customers is that the difference between the internet and the owned infrastructure is in the amount of visibility they already have. Mm-hmm. So you have very little visibility into the internet, whereas in the enterprise space, some visibility already exists. So the context that we are expected to provide when it comes to digital experiences needs to be richer in a sense. And that's where we started to focus on trying to understand or providing more context around how does the owned infrastructure, the owned network affect digital experiences. And one of the first things we started to tackle was how does the actual traffic that's flowing across this owned networks affect the digital experiences. So starting with WAN Edge, for example, how do the changes in the traffic patterns affect digital experience in terms of, you know, your router is suddenly bombarded with high amounts of traffic. How does that correlate with synthetics, for example? Mm-hmm. Or the other use case would be when you have a degradation of a synthetic test, you want to understand what the blast radius is or what the user impact is. Because there's a significant difference between a synthetic test degrading or failing, and there's nobody at that site trying to access the resource you're testing against versus a synthetic test failing or degrading, and there's thousands of users at that location or that site trying to access that resource. The IT or the network engineers will react to those two problems very differently. And that's the context we can bring to the table if we understand the owned infrastructure better.
So it's a context of understanding if the synthetic test is slow, do I care? Because you know how many flows are going through that would be hitting that application.
Exactly. Yeah. So you would know, do you care? And also, does the change in flow somehow affect that synthetic test? And there are multiple use cases apart from just troubleshooting. So one is the obvious one is troubleshooting. You know, there's an update in a particular application suddenly hitting your branch site and everybody's complaining their collaboration tools are not working. It's a very typical scenario. Uh-huh. But there's other scenarios there where you might be hosting an application in a data center and suddenly you have a spike of customer requests from a particular geo. So the test from that geo degrades, but it doesn't degrade because of any internet conditions or anything like that. It degrades because the sheer volume of traffic hitting your WAN edge has increased as well. And this then affects not just troubleshooting, but also, you know, planning of resources, maybe placing, maybe you need to front your application with a CDN. It affects more of these planning-like choices that you need to make. And you can glimpse that by observing flowing either from inside your network across the WAN edge to the outside of your network or the other way around. So coming from the internet or from the outside of your network into your network.
So how are you collecting flows? Do I need to put hardware on-prem or some kind of software agent?
We actually extended the capabilities of our enterprise agent. So our enterprise agent is a piece of software you can run on many different, many different form factors. Amongst other things, it actually runs on Cisco routers or Cat9K switches, for example, and because they provide a compute platform, so a Cisco customer doesn't necessarily even have to deploy their own compute to run the enterprise agent, but it's also distributed as a Docker container or a virtual machine, what we call a Teva appliance. And you know, 1,000S customers will probably already have an enterprise agent deployed somewhere, and they can then repurpose or they can use this enterprise agent as a flow collector. Essentially, what that allows them to do is, if they have a highly centralized infrastructure, they would deploy a virtual appliance with the enterprise agent on it to their hub site. And then from that hub site, they would collect flow information. And that agent acts as a NetFlow proxy. So essentially what it does, it takes the NetFlow stream, which is usually unencrypted from router. So the reason why we have to do that is because a router will not encrypt or compress flow. Mm-hmm. So the enterprise agent receives the flow on one end. It does the compression, encryption, and sends it to the 1000S platform where we store it, analyze it, and make it available for consumption. Now, the nice thing about using the enterprise agent is that it enables, so first of all, it's a managed piece of software and we manage the lifecycle. So as 1000S, we manage the lifecycle of that agent. But the other thing is because it can be deployed in many different ways, it can run on Cisco routers and or switches, the customer can opt for a completely distributed deployment where maybe every site has one of these agents running, and that agent effectively turns the router into a cloud NetFlow reporter, or they can go completely centralized. And the reason why I mentioned that, because traditionally the flow collector tools were always highly centralized. So you had to manage a virtual machine cluster somewhere. Right. And get your flow to a central hub or a series of hubs. And that can be costly, difficult to maintain. It creates operational complexity. Whereas reusing the tool you already have, which is the enterprise agent that is used for synthetics, that is managed by 1000S, reduces that operational strain.
Okay, so let me make sure I understand this. I can have the agent directly on my routers. I can have agents on multiple routers. And instead of having flow records go to a centralized, say, virtual appliance and then into the ThousandEyes cloud, they can go from the routers directly to the ThousandEyes cloud.
That is correct.
If I want to do it that way.
If you wanted to. If you can have a completely distributed deployment, you could have a completely centralized deployment or anything in between.
What kind of flow records do you support? I'm assuming Cisco NetFlow. We've mentioned Cisco along the way. That's the most common type, but there's IPFix and JFlow and other types out there.
So at the moment, we are supporting NetFlow version 9 and IPFix.
And this agent, is it collecting full flow records then, or is it doing any kind of summarizing or catching metadata and sending that off?
It collects full flow records, and we support NetFlow version 9 and IPFix, and we do realize that networks are usually, they're not homogeneous in terms of like the vendors, and you might be using one vendor for your routing and a different vendor for firewalling. We have built this with a vendor agnostic approach in mind. And the agent basically takes the records. It doesn't do any post-processing. It doesn't do any sort of like aggregation. All it does, it does some HTTP compression and encryption. That is it.
Okay. Since you said you support IPFix, so that could be a non-Cisco router. The way this is built, it sounds like I don't need an agent to run directly on the router because I can run the agent as a virtual appliance, and my router that might be using IPFix but isn't a Cisco device can still send flow records to that virtual appliance. So I'm still getting this feature, even if I'm not using Cisco gear.
Yeah, that is correct. So it might be the case that agent is completely independent of any of the routing infrastructure. It might be running on a Cisco router, but a non-Cisco device sends it to that agent, to the IP address of that agent. It might be running on a Cat9K switch where both the Cisco and a non-Cisco device are connected. There's multiple, possible deployment options. It depends on scale, on the routing patterns, where the flows are supposed to go. But yeah, we pride ourselves in flexibility when it comes to the deployment modes for this product.
So, Marco, we're at the end of our time, but if listeners want to find out more about these new capabilities from ThousandEyes, where should they go?
So, thanks for having me. Thanks for this conversation. If to learn more, our listeners can go to the ThousandEyes blog. So www.thousandeyes.com blog. You will see posts about our latest innovations. You can go to our ThousandEyes.com site and request a demo. The Cloud Insights feature today is in a limited preview, which means that it's already available as a preview to all of our customers. And they can also sign up for a 15-day trial of our ThousandEyes platform. That's also available on ThousandEyes.com.
All right, that's ThousandEyes.com, and we'll also have links to all of those links that Marco mentioned in the show notes that accompany this podcast. Marco, thank you for joining us, and thanks to ThousandEyes for being a sponsor. And as always, thank you, the listener, for being here. If you like this episode, you can find it and many more fine free technical podcasts, along with our community blog and community Slack. That's all at packetpushers.net. You can follow us on LinkedIn, hear us on Spotify, and rate us on Apple Podcasts. And last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.